site now.
As we speak.
Not
as
we speak, not video later today. Tape. We're doing a video conference.
Well, it's gonna be taped.
These are going onto the website.
But not video?
Not yet.
Should I wait till we get him on before I...
Who's there?
Okay, let's...
Great.
Oh, there we are.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, gents.
Okay, it's about 110, roughly, 108. We're going to call to order the meeting of the Legislation Committee.
And we will call together the meeting of the Environment Committee.
Can we bring Marty up, too? Marty Gleason?
On this? Sure.
Yeah.
Marty, have a seat. And we have for legislation, and I think also on environment, legislators Avenanti, who's sitting as chair, Harcum, and Myers, and for... legislation and Nona, and for legislation, all of the above plus legislative purpose.
Yes, can I give a little lead in?
Yes, the first item on the agenda for the joint committee meeting is proposed legislation to expand our recycling local law.
Mr. Chairman, may I also make a comment on that? We have legislator Peter Harcum, who has shepherded this through and pushed hard for this legislation before us. As you know, he was the chairman of the committee until just about 2 weeks ago when we exchanged positions. And so this has been his effort. So he's going to give us an explanation of what this is about and the urgency in passing this out.
So as the sponsor, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you, both Mr. Chairs. I'm never quite sure whether that's Messrs. Chairs or Mr. Chairs. Thank you. This was something that, as you know, we've been working on in the Environment Committee. And even though I was the sponsor of this, I really sponsored it on behalf of the entire committee. We had great unanimity on this. And you may recall this was something we as a county started last year when the MRF bought the sorting equipment. And what we needed was the enabling legislation to expand the definition of plastics in our solid waste law so we can begin 3 through 7. What we wanted to do is a couple things. The folks from Environmental Facilities wanted a little time to just sort of tweak what the exemptions were, if I'm correct, gentlemen. We wanted to tweak the exemptions. We wanted to put in a starting date of June 1st for two reasons. So we would, A, would have time to educate the public, and B, they would have time to get the equipment up and running and work the bugs out. Our friend Marty Gleason from the law department has been shepherding this at his end. He's made those changes. As I said, we had lengthy discussions in the Environment Committee, and we thought it might be appropriate to do a joint just to shepherd this final version through and hopefully get it on the blue sheet for tonight.
If I may just make a notation, thank you for the explanation. We should note for the record that the Board of Legislators has enlarged the conference room. It is now about 5 miles long, whereas it used to be from here to the wall. We now are looking at a screen. We have a video conference in place with members of the county's Department of Environmental Facilities. And perhaps we should have them identify themselves just for the record, and we'll see if this works. But we're staring at a video screen, a flat screen, and I'm assuming that they are looking back at us. Is that true?
That's correct. All right. We have Lou Vitrone, Mario Parisi, and Jim Arnett from Environmental Facilities.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would just make one notation if I can. This is bringing our law up to date with the practices of our community. People for a long time have wanted us to recycle more materials, and I just quickly looked around my kitchen, grabbed three pieces of plastic, and I have here a kid's cup, which is a sippy cup, which is a number 5. I have the cover of that, which is a this one is a number. I saw the number 7. And here is the top to a coffee container, which is a number 4. All commonplace items in the normal kitchen, many of which I'm sure are recycled or tossed in the recycled bin today. Yes. It's costing the county money to isolate these items and then to dispose of them with the garbage. So, number 1, we're going to be doing something good for the environment by recycling these additional items. And number two, we're going to be saving ourselves some money because we will no longer have to separate items that were incorrectly tossed in with the recyclables. So
and
I commend the authors.
If I could add,
sure.
Number three is that I believe there's an aftermarket now for these numbers, which makes us able to bring in even more revenue.
So I commend those who brought it to this point and the administration for working along on this, and just say thank you. And Mr. Nona?
Well, let me note the arrival of Legislator Freda Williams and Chair Ken Jenkins joining us. Why don't we have Marty Gleason explain what changes were made, what the law encompasses, and I particularly like you to focus on what's excluded now, because it's important that there's still exclusions to what can be recycled.
Right.
And we ought to be clear on that, and then have the gentleman from the Environmental Facilities Department add any comments they have as to the impact of this law.
If I may just note, as I look at this legislation, what we've really done is clarify what was always the practice. We've really just added what the law used to say was we would accept plastics coated one or two, and now we've used some clarifying words that say with resin identification code, and we're adding through number seven.
Right.
So we're going from one through seven.
And we've added the exemptions. No, the exemptions are new.
And
the exclusions, I mean, not exemptions.
Well, my understanding is that these were pretty much all excluded anyway, but we're just now clarifying.
Right, but we've codified them.
We've codified it, right.
Okay. Mr. Bleas.
You guys okay? Since last time on, the proposed legislation was referred to the Department of Environmental Facilities, who weighed in and actually incorporated some language into the proposed legislation that, as you say, Mr. Chairman, excludes and makes clear exactly what items are excluded under the law. For example, what the law now includes is illustrative examples of the types of items that are not recyclable under the term plastic film. I think last time on Legislative Norm had indicated that was a fairly vague term, plastic film, and he wanted some examples. So there's some illustrative examples, non-exclusive.
That's the dry cleaning bags and the packaging materials.
Correct. That are now included that weren't included before. Additionally, there is a differentiation of the terms large rigid plastics and small rigid plastics. And again, there are illustrative examples of each type that are not recyclable under each of those terms. So before we had just the term rigid plastics, now we have the terms large rigid plastics and small rigid plastics, both of which now include examples of what we mean by those particular terms. Another thing that was done was there are illustrative examples of the types of items that are not recyclable under the term plastic foam materials. So that's a term that was in the original law, which now includes examples for what we mean by those terms, and you can see that in the law. And finally, but an additional change that was made was exclusion of containers that held potentially hazardous materials from plastics required to be recycled. And then again, illustrative examples of the types of items that are not recyclable under such terms. If you recall last time, Commissioner Lauro indicated that would be a prime example of something that would continue to not be recyclable as something that was contaminated and wouldn't be recyclable. And now that terminology is actually used in the law, and again, with illustrative examples of what is meant by that term. Finally, exclusion of building materials from the plastics required to be recycled is a term that's included. And there are illustrative examples of the types of items that are not recyclable under that term. In making these changes, I think we tried to continue the format as was previously in the law, and that was we didn't try to define them as much as we gave illustrative examples. That was the format that was previously used, and this is an attempt to sort of continue that format by giving examples of what is meant by those terms. Additionally, as Legislator Markham mentioned, the effective date was changed, I believe, from February 1st, 2011 to June 1st, 2011. And that is the extent of the changes that were made.
Why was that necessary?
Two reasons. One, to give the public education as that these changes were coming. The other was that there were some delays in the equipment arrival and installation. And then once it's installed, they want to make sure that all the bugs are worked out of the system so that when they do start taking large amounts of this material, that they'll be able to integrate it seamlessly.
Question, if I may, to either the administration or to Mr. Harkin. This is a mandate. This says that we shall recycle, correct? Is that what this law is about?
Right.
Mr. Gleason?
Yes, that's correct.
So this is adding to the mandate to the public that you shall do this as of June 1, 2011.
Right. It's expanding the current definition.
Right. But that's also the mandate section of the statute.
That's correct.
Because that means if somebody does this beforehand, they're not in violation of any law. It's just they're doing it too soon.
Where do you see that?
Correct?
It's not here.
It's not here.
All that's been amended is the definition. Okay. The other part of the law that says you shall recycle is not
correct.
This is about the definition of recycling.
Right.
This is a subdivision without the
You want me to read it, please?
Okay. But I just want to make sure that we understand that we're adding to the section that mandates that people do this.
Okay.
This is not just expanding our own capacity. We're also expanding the mandates, which is another reason.
Right, which is why they changed the definition.
Exactly. That's where I'm coming to. That's
right.
Why we're changing the definition, and that's why we're changing the effective date, because this is a mandate that says everybody in the county shall recycle these materials.
Yeah.
The next question I have is, does this apply countywide or only in the district?
Countywide.
So it's a countywide mandate?
Yeah.
Are we sure?
Yes. We discussed that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just want to clarify. Absolutely. Get everything all together in one meeting.
No,
so
absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Lastly, is do any of these other items that we're excluding presently have resin identification codes stamped on them?
Gentlemen, can you
most of
that?
The items we exclude do not have items stamped on them.
No. None of the oversized items like the building materials. The plastic film. I don't want to say none of them would have a code on them, but the large majority would not be coded.
Okay, so if someone accidentally puts something in that has a code 5 or 7 on it, and it's one of our exclusions, we're not going to be enforcing a law against them and fining them for being overzealous in recycling. Correct?
Absolutely not. We get those items now, and what we try to do is manually pick them out and put them aside and try to market them separately if we can.
Because it can be confusing to the public, and we don't want to discourage people from complying with the law in recycling. I think the message here is that if it's potentially hazardous, be careful with it and don't recycle it, because it might be hazardous to you, it'll be hazardous to those who collect it and those who sort it. But on the other hand, we're not going to go out and enforce a law against somebody who accidentally tosses in a motor oil container or something like that.
No, that's correct. And we've never enforced against anybody who's gone above and beyond and put even more in their recycling.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we have in the audience Steve, is it Pisano?
Rosario.
Okay, sorry. Sorry.
Sorry, my handwriting is so poor.
From the American Chemistry Council.
It was just the first letter there.
For yes. Thank you for joining us today.
Sure.
Could you explain your presence here, and do you have a comment?
Well, we are very interested. I represent the American Chemistry Council.
Come up to the table. So we can.
That's
for
Tom.
Right there.
Just another time. 1:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent the American Chemistry Council, which represents the business of chemistry and plastics technology here in the state. I actually come out of the plastics side of our house, and we are always very much interested in programs that look to enhance plastics recycling, and we're always accused of always saying no and opposing. We believe this is one that we can come out and support. I have my technical people reviewing the bill, but based on my knowledge, it looks pretty good. And at some point, if the committee or the legislature holds a public hearing, we'd like to be able to come out and support that.
And tonight we'll be setting the public hearing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
I'm here.
Will probably be in 2 weeks.
November 8th. Three weeks.
3 weeks, right.
Yeah, November 8th would be the public hearing.
Have you been working with our technical people?
When is the term line supposed to come out? Because we shouldn't do them all at the same time.
We have to set that tonight because it's over.
So my point is we want to make sure we don't overlap all these meetings.
Okay.
Because it's a local law.
It's a local law.
I don't think we'll get a large number of people coming out for this.
No, we've gotten a number of letters from municipalities in favor.
They're in favor.
Yeah.
The only question I wanted to ask Mr. Rosario is, Have you been working with our technical people in DEF on this to see if they're to explore in the future other ways that we can work together to take more items out of the waste stream? I mean, clearly there's all of these things that we have to exclude because it's not, I would assume it's not technically feasible for them to handle, and secondly, there's not a market for them. Have you had a chance to work with them?
We haven't, but we would certainly be amenable to working with the department and with the county legislature. I've had one or two conversations with your council, Chris Crane. So, yes, we're certainly available here as a resource.
Yeah, because one thing that seems to me is that somewhere along the way, somebody is requiring that numbers be put on these products, and it's not us. We don't have that control.
I believe it's federal.
I think it would be federal also. And I would just want to make sure that in the future we keep in sync with what's going on the federal level and recycle as much as possible. It's good for our environment, it's good for our economy, and it's good for our tax rate.
Absolutely. Well, many more of these products are being labeled, and I think you asked a very good question regarding containers that are labeled and are exempted or excluded here. For example, motor oil is a number 2 HDPE. Which is recyclable. It's got to be cleaner than just throwing it into the container. But that is a container that is very much desirable and recyclable.
The problem is the normal homeowner can't clean it because we don't want them cleaning. We don't want to give anybody any idea that they should clean this in the sink.
Well, absolutely.
You know, I mean, that's contaminate the water supply.
Sanitary.
To that point, the commissioner also at our last meeting said that a lot of the after product for these products, when they're recycled, involve babies and children, and that's why they don't use the ones with contaminants in them.
Right.
I think at this point it would be appropriate to entertain a motion.
I'd like to move for both committees, please.
Second.
Thank you, Steve. Good to see you. Second for both committees.
For the legislation committee, all in favor, we're voting this out for public, for all purposes.
All purposes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None.
And for the environment committee?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No opposition. We will note for the record that it is now 1:25, so we have an opportunity to have this on tonight's agenda. If our staff would quickly take our signatures and rush it down to the clerk.
We'll set up public.
And I want to thank Mr. Rosario for coming forward.
Thank you.
We look forward to working with you again, and we ask you to get in touch with our technical people at DEF.
So
at least there's some communication going on.
Are there any other comments? Anybody else want to make a comment on this law?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, public hearing and both.
Right. Any other comments or questions about this?
Yeah, it'll be the 8th, Steve.
Chris, do we have anything else in the
environment? I mean, Greg.
Not right now.
Any minutes?
No.
All right. Are we going to adjourn or are we going to recess until...
Adjourn.
And then we'll come back at 3:30.
We have a duly called meeting for 3:30.
Okay. All right. Move to adjourn
3 o'clock. There's a motion to adjourn environment.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Meeting's adjourned.
Okay. Before we invite community services to join us for the joint meeting, I want to take up two waivers. These are two waivers, right? Mm-hmm. One is Anthony LaCroce and one is Diane Stern. They both have jobs with other organizations. They need a waiver, and this was on the agenda last week, but they did not have the required language in the waiver, and I believe they now have included the language.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Is there a second?
I will second it, and I will support it without prejudice because I want to review the materials more carefully.
Okay. All in favor?
Thank you, Chris.
Aye.
Opposed? None.
Thank you.
Okay.
I shall both items, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, that's both items, right?
Both, yes. Mr. LaCroce, who was in DPW, who's going to work for Avports Management, LLC, and Diane Stone from Stern from Social Services, who's going to work for Family Ties and Christmas.
Okay,
both good people. Okay, I welcome Legislator Alfreda Williams, Chair of the Community Services Committee.
Okay. Do we still need these guys?
No, thank you, gentlemen. We'll let you. Unless you want
to. I think they're trying to turn us off.
No, cut them off.
I don't have
at the bottom of the
thank
screen.
Guys. Thank you, Marty.
And on the left hand side, it looks like a phone. Just put that in. It looks like a little phone hanger.
I know. Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Bye bye.
It's like turn Skype. That bad boy off. I'll go look at myself.
Can we get the Giants game on here, or is this Fox 5?
Oh, we have King Vision here. Sorry.
I sent a letter. Didn't do any good.
Thank you, Mel.
You have
Verizon.
Have
Chris, thank you.
You're welcome.
Marty.
Okay, so do you want to open? Do you have a quorum for your
committee? If the chairman was
chairman,
yeah, we got a little break because this thing just fell apart on generating
dinner work.
No, I know.
The
chairman is
there.
Is it a bag of lunch still a
business?
Yeah. I can never get that. Okay,
well, that shows how old it is when they still did credit card receipts like that.
They bank on people not saving it.
Yeah.
Two legislation, many of the community services, and legislation is to receive and file.
Do we have any minutes?
Two.
Okay, somebody want to move our minutes?
So moved. Is there a ledge?
Okay, wait, just give me a second. Okay, we've got Mary Beth Doe's comments.
Yeah.
Okay. Peter, let's say Hawkins has moved the two sets of minutes for legislation.
Second.
So, give me a second.
Thank you.
With the normal Burton caveat that if we find something pending.
One of these days.
Any necessary corrections?
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Next item is a discussion of the proposed cyberbullying law, which went through some amendments. I'll ask Mr. Gleason to come up, and I guess we're going to have some comments on this. I have some extensive comments on this, which I'm going to save until we hear from Mr. Gleason and any other legislators. Did you open your committee?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you want to open your committee?
For the Committee on Community Services, we have Legislator Myers and our chair, Mr. Jenkins, in attendance, and it is 1:31. And I call the committee to order.
Mr. Gleason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since the last time this proposed legislation was before both committees, the Chairman Nona requested that the county attorney issue an opinion on two separate matters. The first matter being whether or not the proposed legislation on cyberbullying, if adopted, would be preempted under state law. That was question number one. And question number two was should the proposed cyberbullying legislation currently before the County Board of Legislators be amended further to make it more likely to withstand a constitutional challenge under the First Amendment. With regard to the first question on state preemption, the county attorney indicated in an opinion dated September 29, 2010, that he did not believe, based on his review of the proposed legislation, that it would be, or that it could be conclusively determined that it would be preempted under state law. In light of the fact that it did not appear to be inconsistent with law and that inconsistent with state law, preventing the operation of state law in any way. Further, did not appear that the harassment statutes of the penal law provide an express preemption, that is a preemption that is written in so many words indicating that local laws with regard to the same or similar subject matter are preempted. And finally, the county attorney indicated that it did not appear conclusively that a determination could be made that the proposed local law would be preempted based on implied preemption, that being the existence of a legislative intent to occupy the field through a comprehensive and detailed statutory regulatory scheme. And with regard to what statutes we're talking about the penal law harassment statutes. There are many of them. The two statutes that the county attorney really keyed on were penal law sections 240.25 and 240.30, which are the relevant language is set forth in the opinion, but in many cases, the conduct that is prohibited by those statutes would overlap with conduct that is would be prohibited by the proposed legislation. The county attorney also indicated that there were also a number of differences between the proposed legislation and the penal law harassment statute, so that they were at the same time as overlapping in terms of their scope. At the same time, they were also not identical in any way. And having made that determination, the county attorney still opined that he did not feel that there was enough evidence to indicate that a determination could be made that the proposed cyber bullying legislation would be preempted under state law. Unless there's any questions on that, I'll go forward on that.
Yeah, I have some questions. Any else have some questions?
No, go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Question number one, why do you say conclusively?
Conclusively in terms of,
yeah,
can we
you
say?
It can't be conclusively determined.
I think we're saying that to absolute certainty, it's sometimes difficult to tell whether or not legislation preempts.
So you're saying like 99%, 95%, 80%? I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure where you're going with conclusively.
It can't be determined that it is.
What are the differences between the harassment statutes and this proposed law? What do you think the differences are?
Those differences are set forth on page 4 of the opinion that's dated September 29th.
You mean?
Of the opinion.
Right.
Okay. And there's a listing, if you look under inconsistency analysis, on the bottom of that page.
On bottom of page 4.
Correct. On the bottom of page 4. The first difference that's listed is a mens rea. Mens rea being the culpable mental state necessary.
Right.
To
so what do you see the difference being?
The difference being that with regard, and again, there are two statutes that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. With regard to Penal Law Section 240.25, the defendant has to intentionally and repeatedly harass another person. Now, that term is not defined, what's meant by the term harass, but that's the intent. And with regard to Penal Law Section 240.30, it requires the offender act with, quote, intent to harass, annoy, threaten, or alarm another person.
Right.
Again, a little bit more of a twist on 240.25, but again, a specific intent. With regard to the proposed cyberbullying legislation, it requires an intentional written, verbal, or physical act or conduct directed at a specific other person on the part of the offender that such offender would reasonably know could result in a particular detrimental impact, okay? Which we think, again, the county attorney indicates that that's a subtle difference, but nonetheless a difference.
But you still have to prove that the person would know that you're going to cause a detrimental impact.
Right, right.
So, I mean,
true.
I just don't see...
Well,
I mean, it's a difference. Is it a difference without a distinction?
Well, it's definitely... We did indicate it was a subtle difference. We're not, okay. We're not trying to post this as a
right.
It's something that need be.
And then the second point is that under the harassment statute, you need more than one act, whereas
right.
under our law, you can have one email,
right.
one nasty email,
right.
and you can be prosecuted.
Well, let me qualify that. That's correct in the way this was written. But again, the county attorney, in response to Chairman Noma's request, did provide a revised copy of legislation, and that revised legislation would tend to eliminate the single incident.
Right.
Type of thing. Yeah, but as originally proposed, the proposed cyberbullying legislation could be predicated on one, albeit severe.
Right, but now it has to be pervasive and persistent.
Right. Now, under the revised draft that's before both committees now, it requires not only just one act, it requires...
Right, so there's no difference there.
Yeah, a series of different things.
Okay, we're joined by Legislator Wright. The third item, you say, 240.30, requires communication with a person, so that if under the harassment statute, if the law is not directed to a person,
right,
then you can't prosecute under that statute.
Some cases have held, some decisions seem to intimate that in order for 240.30, Penal Law Section 240.30, to become operative, there must be a directed communication directed to the complaint victim.
Yeah, the only case I saw that said that was a case with a concurring opinion.
Right. There is a concurring opinion there.
But I would take a look at this case, People v. Kachanowski, 186 Miscellaneous Section 441, where some disgruntled former boyfriend posted on a website suggestive photographs of his ex-girlfriend with her address and telephone number and solicitations for third parties to contact her.
But and he it was held he could be prosecuted even though it wasn't directed toward her. And that's an appellate term case in the second department where we are.
We also gave People versus Mines an example.
Yeah, that's another one. Different. So I'm not sure there's a difference there either.
We didn't say it was conclusive.
This is an appellate term case, and as far as I know, it hasn't been overturned. So I just question how different they really are, you know, particularly since, as we'll talk a little later, that the DA feels that the harassment statute gives them the tools that they need to prosecute this kind of crime. But anyway, I'm sorry, if you want to add something.
It was just the final, to complete this thought, the final differentiation was the proposed cyberbullying legislation uses the term emotional health and substantial detrimental effect.
Now that raises an interesting issue. So under the harassment statute, the prosecutor doesn't have to prove harm to someone's emotional health in order to get a conviction, right?
Right.
Under this statute, it seems to me the prosecutor has to prove that there's emotional harm to someone's emotional health.
Under the revised statute?
Yeah.
Under the revised statute, as recommended by the county attorney, the county attorney recommends that there be some proof.
That would be part of the prosecutor's case.
Yes.
So the prosecutor, to prove the case under this proposed statute, would have to put in evidence probably psychiatric or some sort of medical evidence of the effect on the victim's health.
Right.
And the victim would have to be willing to let that information be made public at a trial.
Okay.
I think. I mean, that's the way I read it and discussing it with some prosecutors.
I think there's no question
of that. Yeah, yeah. So that's something to keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that there's a problem sometimes with prosecutions of where the victims are young people with them coming forward and wanting to expose personal information. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point.
Let's say the
Hawk. Thank you. I, you know, not being from the courts, I can't speak to the willingness of young people to speak on the record of medical issues, as you suggested. I know that's an issue, but you know, just having a daughter in high school and one in middle school, and having heard of these incidents in their schools, there is no doubt that even one or two times, these things are devastating to young people. Again, not commenting on which law they're covered by. So, you know, the fact that there needs to be some sort of proof of an emotional trauma, you know, having spoken to parents involved with these things, that they're incredibly traumatic. So, you know, the trauma is there, but to your point as to whether they will
speak on the record. It's a question
of
speaking on the record.
Sure.
Which is going to be a problem. I'm sorry, go ahead.
As not only just speaking on the record, as well as having a court record indicating that this person has some sort of psychiatric disturbance, which could follow that person into later life and be used against them in a negative manner, of course. You know, when someone has a psychiatric record of any kind, right away they become suspect to all kinds of things, and even if it's 10 or 15 years old, it carries through.
It might be cool.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry.
It probably is originally written, the complainant would have to be present to make this complaint anyway.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not...
The question is whether you need whether a psychiatrist or a doctor also to
right, but again, the testimony would have to be that a reasonable person would suffer some emotional stress.
Yeah.
The person would have to know that, and without a complaint coming forward, basically saying that I was...
But for instance, in the tort, this is kind of modeled after the tort of an infliction of emotional distress, intentional infliction. To prove that tort in court, as not as a criminal matter, as a tort matter, you actually can't just have someone get on the stand and say, oh, gee, I've been terribly harmed by this. You've got to have a medical proof, and that means a psychiatrist or a doctor has to get on the stand and testify about confidential information about that person's treatment, which... Yes.
Just in general, and just on that particular point, I don't know this, in a case, if you had statistics and you had standards that came from the professional organization that said this type of activity would have this type of result, would that, in a court case, suffice? In other words, you wouldn't have to say that it happened to person X, right, that said if you got these type of emails or you had this type of activity happen to you and you had a professional, you know, I guess a professional, what would you call that, an expert witness, that would say that, so it would not be to both of your points of saying that you would not want to have a individual tainted, you wouldn't want to make the victim a victim again, right? So I would suspect that, I'm not sure if we would do something in the language differently or whether or not in existing cases in other places, in other tort law that you were just referring to, that you use an expert witness to suggest that if you suffered this type of treatment, this is the result of it. So it would, you know, it would connect, even though it was not exactly the person saying that.
I don't think you could do that. It's like if you have an automobile accident, you claim you got whiplash, and you don't want to testify you got whiplash or have your doctor, you can't have some expert get up there and say, well, if this car struck another car at 50 miles an hour, the people generally suffer whiplash. You couldn't do that.
But don't they do that in insurance right now that says that if you have this type of diagnosis, that this is the type of treatment that you would get for that?
But you got to put the diagnosis on the person making the diagnosis on the witness stand. The doctor's going to have to say, I diagnose this person as having this injury. I diagnose this person as having this psychiatric or psychological damage.
No, but I'm also suggesting that
you can't, the
psychological damage that says that you receive, as Legislator Holcomb just mentioned, it's an interesting question to say how you, whether or not we have to change the language up to ensure that we were not, again, making a victim.
I don't think you can get around that.
I'm not sure, right? To be honest with you, but the reality is that, you know, given all the scenarios that we've seen, it's not just the young people that are in this case. The most recent incidents that we've all seen lately are adults, right? You know, they're college people, they're college level people, or older, that have been, you know, subject to the same kind of things that would be cyberbullying. For lack of a better term, and they could be, and they certainly could be prosecuted under many different items, but having one that is specific for the type of activity that we're suggesting, utilizing, you know, the electronic means, et cetera, of bullying or harassing someone, I think it's a refinement of that. So I understand your point, and I think that it's one that we need to understand.
Well, to that point, would it just be easier to switch what we're proposing here more in line with the state law that doesn't have that requirement to prove the harm?
Then what are you adding? What are you adding? What are you adding then? If you've got a law that accomplishes the purpose, why are you adding a new law other than to feel good and to make it look good to the
John,
public that we're doing
with
something?
With all due respect, Mr. Chair, it's not a feel good measure. It is filling in the gaps. You can agree or disagree.
There are no gaps. That's the problem. To the extent you're filling in gaps, you're creating more problems by trying to create a law that fills in gaps when there really are no gaps. Well, but anyway, we have to go to a second issue, which is also a major issue here.
We sort of got into it a little bit in our last discussion, but with regard to the First Amendment, and assuming that other parts of this legislation that deal with cyberbullying that creates a reasonable fear of physical injury or a reasonable fear of property damage, that's not really so much in question as this notion of causing substantial detrimental effect on the person's emotional well-being is the issue for First Amendment privileges, for First Amendment purposes that we're mostly concerned about with respect to this legislation if it's passed. It's a little bit of a gray area. Chairman Nolan sent along testimony of an expert in the First Amendment who testified before Congress with respect to the federal cyberbullying legislation and indicated that he felt, in his opinion, that intentional infliction of emotional distress might prove to be an area in which cyberbullying legislation couldn't be based upon. He did indicate that with respect to that particular tort, to make it satisfy First Amendment challenges, it probably should be very clear that there is a cause and effect relationship. That, in other words, in order to sustain a First Amendment challenge, that there be actual proof that the victim suffered emotional distress. And if you recall from the first draft of our legislation, the legislation required that the actor
just know that, reasonably know, that his actions could cause a substantial detrimental effect on the mental emotional health of the victim. It didn't require that there actually be any. To make it closer to the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress, and therefore to try and satisfy First Amendment concerns, County Attorney recommends, as did Professor O'Neill, who was the witness in, before Congress, that it include an actual cause and effect, that the legislation include that, because that would be closer to the civil tort, okay, which has been, I don't think that most people, and Professor O'Neill said this, and I think most people, most legal scholars would probably agree, that intentional infliction of emotional distress is not protected by the First Amendment. That when someone engages in outrageous conduct that is deliberately intended to cause emotional distress to an individual, that that should not be, okay, and that's based on outrageous conduct. And again, that's a word that's constantly used when you talk about the tort of intentional infliction of emotional stress. It has to be outrageous conduct, not merely opinion, not offensive conduct, but outrageous conduct. Okay, and there were some examples in prior opinions that were issued by the county attorney on this legislation to sort of go into examples of what how outrageous that would be. But in any event,
but I don't think our statute deals with outrage. Does it really?
Well, it talks about substantial emotional distress as opposed to, you know,
But that doesn't address the conduct. That addresses the effect.
Well, again, what we, what the county attorney recommended was that the prior legislation was provided for was that a reasonable person, under the circumstances, we began from the beginning. The previous statute defined harassment or bullying as any intentional written, verbal, or physical act of conduct directed at a specific other person, which is severe, persistent, or pervasive, and serves no legitimate purpose, and that a reasonable person under the circumstances would know could result in, and then one of the factors, one of the things could be, could result in a substantial detrimental effect on a person's emotional well-being. That has been rewritten in this revised draft to now read any intentional written, verbal, or physical act or conduct targeting a specific other person, which is severe, persistent, and pervasive. Okay, to your point about outrageous conduct, certainly something that is severe, persistent, and pervasive would be the language that you were trying to use instead of the word outrageous. Okay, and served on legitimate purpose. Now, that appeared before and appears now. In terms of trying to exclude First Amendment protected type of activity, that's a phrase that's currently used in the penal law harassment statutes as well as other parts of the penal law. Again, something what is legitimate is something that's non-coercive. It has some beneficial purpose other than a coercive, intimidating type of communication. And I think that that's what that language is intended to convey. And at least that's the way that phrase has been defined. And going on with the revised, it says, and that a reasonable person under the circumstances would know could result in and does in fact result in. That's the new language that was added to include that it has to be a cause and effect. Again, following Professor O'Neill's testimony before Congress, that it included an actual effect element. That would actually require that there be a burden of proof on the effect of substantial detrimental effect on emotional health.
Yeah, you saw the decision, the Second Circuit decision, which indicated, or at least Judge Shimlin's decision that indicated some concern about criminalizing. If it's a criminal law statute, it's got to be looked at a little differently than just a civil tort.
Right, and we included that. That's the case of Vivens versus the City of New York, and basically, if one of the facts of that case, there was a candidate for lieutenant governor. She received in the mail some non-threatening communications which simply alarmed people of the Jewish faith, as this candidate was, as to certain things that were going on in the world. The candidate complained to the New York City Police Department that she felt annoyed and alarmed by this material, and that technically met the definition of the statute, that you can't send someone a communication that's annoying and alarming. It's intended to annoy and alarm them. And
half the communications we receive.
Right, yes.
We're excluded from this. We're confused.
Annoying and alarming conduct is protected, and Judge Scheinman found that and held the statute unconstitutional. And the city.
Which Scheinman?
Shearer, not Judy.
Not
the federal judge, Shearer.
Not the television judge, Scheinman.
Just wondering.
But there are many Scheinmans.
But yeah, she lives in Grand.
But in any event, on appeal, it was reversed in part on appeal, but not for the reasons that Judge Scheinman had found it unconstitutional. It was reversed on other grounds, and the Second Circuit did not rule on the constitutionality of the statute. But I think it is fair to say that a purely offensive language is protected by the First Amendment unless it rises to some aggravated factor, unless it becomes a true threat or some type of communication that's otherwise prescribed in the First Amendment. And certainly under the Vivis case, that conduct could certainly not be described as prescribed.
Okay. Any less comments? We'll open the floor for discussion. Yes.
You know what? I thank you, Mr. Chair. What might be helpful, and we do this frequently with pieces of legislation. When representatives from the DA were here, they were very non-committal as to what they felt about this, what they felt about the state law, and I think what would be helpful to me as a legislator is to your point about not necessarily them, what this law does, what the state, just a side-by-side comparison almost, you know, and that might address your point, whether it is duplicative, whether it's not, plus there's a similar measure to this in Albany. You know, what are the three or four on the menu? And let's see.
I support that, Mr. Chairman. I think that because that is also helpful. I mean, there's not a question that there is a specific issue that just happens to be, as you might look at it and say, it's an issue that's right in front of us now, right? As far as an issue of cyberbullying, and how do we address that? How do we utilize the existing law and educate people to let them know what is out there? Maybe one of the things that ends up happening from our legislation or attempt at trying to shape some legislation is that it says, well, maybe we need to expend some more dollars in educating people in this particular aspect and concern on harassment, etc. I know that the DA goes around, as she did when they came in and explained it to us, and said they go to schools all the time and do that. I know over the weekend I happened to be at a workshop for a specific group of young people on cyberbullying, etc. But we know that in college right now, we know that all of them have basically, because of the incident at Rutgers, have basically stepped back and said whatever we were doing isn't getting through, and I understand from a legislative perspective to say, are we making something up to that's already out there? Well, we have to figure out something to make sure that we're protecting our young people. We have several higher institutes of learning in Westchester County, and we need to give the young people the opportunity to help protect themselves and to make sure that we are doing everything we can from a law perspective. So I really appreciate the effort that you've been making through this, because there's some constitutionality questions that you've been raising right from the very beginning as far as free speech is concerned. And I believe all of us that are here are supportive of the free speech discussion and trying to figure out what's right. But at a certain point in time, you know, there's things that are crossing the line, and at this point in time in our environment, in our world, the lines are way, way blurred, right? As far as what is considered outrageous. I mean, we're in the last 2 weeks of election. We're all getting bombarded by, you know, by the ads of the various candidates, people that we know and we respect, that are saying things about other folks that we go, what does that have to do with you? So that at this point, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Mr. Harkin that we should get that side-by-side comparison, because that will be very helpful for us. Making the adjustments that Mr. Gleason and the county attorney's office have made based on the comments have gone in a direction I think that would make a lot of people comfortable with such, you know, a majority of the legislation. We know it's not fully baked yet, right? But we need to get some additional information so that we can at least hear with other things that we need to be concerned with. Because I think one of the other problems that we've been having through this process is that, you know, we're looking at it from our viewpoint. And as you know, all of us have, you know, a lot of us here have, all of us here have children, right? So that we're looking at it from one point of view, we may need to also continue and hear from the public and see if there's things that we're missing, and see how we can shape that in the legislation as well.
Good comments. Anybody else? I just want to say, I wasn't, by saying feel good, I wasn't belittling at all your concerns. And let me just back up. Cyberbullying is a problem, and I think that your, you know, the sponsors of this legislation are very well intentioned. They want to address a problem, and they want to address it in a way maybe that it hasn't been addressed. And, you know, I don't mean to criticize that. I just mean to alert you all to at least, partially from a policy perspective and partially from a legal perspective, of what unintended consequences might flow. And that's why I think we need to take a real good look. And that's why I've spent, and Betsy has spent a fair amount of time looking at all of these cases under the harassment law to see how far they've been able to, you know, extend it and use it. And it seems like it's been successfully used. Maybe that needs to be tweaked. But the concerns about trying to expand beyond that, which we are doing to a certain extent, you know, do raise these issues about the First Amendment. And, you know, I ran across an interesting quote by Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter. It is a fair summary of history to say that the safeguards of liberty have often been forged in controversies involving not very nice people. And the Supreme Court now has this case of, which is truly outrageous, showing up to some poor, you know, this soldier who died in battle and you know, putting up all these nasty signs. And you know, I would like to think that that's not protected, but, you know, it may be. And then I was talking to some acquaintances of mine who are prosecutors about, you know, if you took this, you made, you know, emotional distress an issue, what do you have to prove? Do you have to use that to prove the case, which you don't have to do now under the harassment statute? And they told me, you know, it's hard enough sometimes to get young victims and parents to come forward, that I just wonder whether at the end of the day this is going to be used by the DA. If we enact it, are they really going to use it? Are they going to say, look, we got the harassment statute. It's a lot easier. I'm almost done.
Yeah, no.
It's a lot easier for us to go under the existing law than to try to prove these additional elements that we have to prove. And I think that the solution is really is education, and maybe we could play a larger role in that area. You know, I read a comment looking at one of these comments about the cyberbullying statute that said that, you know, you could have a swimming pool. Little kids sometimes drown in swimming pools, and you could put signs up and fences and, you know, all kinds of safeguards, but the best thing to do is to teach the kids how to swim. And it just seems to me education is going to be the key here, because you start hauling people through court, I don't know what's going to happen. And there's been some very sad situations, I agree. The question is how to deal with them in the right way. But anyway, sorry.
Well, thanks. No, to your point, and thank you for your explanation. One of the things I would suggest we add to that analysis, I know you and Betsy are always very thorough about looking at the court decisions, but those of us who are lay people don't always have the benefit of that reading. If you may want to include some summaries of some of that in the analysis as we look at different statutes and what are the courts saying, what are the boundaries, where have we gone so far, that would, I think, be good information for the
I think we should get the district attorney's office back in to tell us about some of the cases they've had, mm-hmm. You know, more detailed.
And maybe even if they would use
state. Well, we can ask them.
Well, we did, but
they were
to be polite, they were non-committal, and that's the polite word.
And that was very polite.
Evasive.
They were extremely evasive. But at the end, Mr. Chairman, one of the other thing, and all of us are kind of grappling with this, especially since this is targeted to individuals that are under 18. And really balancing trying to, you know, educate and to appropriately, you know, to appropriately punish someone when they take steps without criminalizing them. I mean, it's a really delicate balance to say you did something wrong, but you're a kid, and you know what, you're learning through that. But, you know, we have to try to get to that balance, and, you know, doing the research that you're doing is going to help us. To find that, again, you know, we go to and we've seen too many incidents right now where somebody's horseplay turned out to be someone's funeral, right? And we really, really have to come up with an answer that we can help our law enforcement community, our education community, or more important, our community at large.
I mean, an interesting question, and it's a suicide off the George Washington Bridge. I don't know that this law would enable you to prosecute those people.
No, because it says that the person is under 18, right?
Even if it's over 18, I mean, there wasn't. The harassment statute enough. I don't know, but they basically posted a video of somebody.
They posted several videos of...
You know, and is that... Would that fall under the statute? Would it be pervasive enough, persistent enough?
Well, I think that the video camera would have been pervasive, right?
If it's one video?
My understanding was it was several, so, right. Unfortunately, maybe the way it works now is that pervasive or... the way that things work now, when you have one piece of information and it could go to millions of people at one time, as opposed to, instead of doing 500 emails or 5 million emails, you could just do one and go to 5 billion people. It's kind of the same thing.
See, under the state harassment statute, like that case of the guy who posted the pictures of his girlfriend, I mean, that they prosecuted him. You know, that worked. I don't know what they have in New Jersey, but... Anyways.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments? So can we get that comparison? Can we invite the DA in?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody else we should invite? We had the schools. I don't think we're close to that.
There's one, if I may, I'm sorry. There's one group. They're a school group. I don't know if they could comment on the legislation in particular. Maybe I can feel them out first. They're called the Elizabeth Butler Foundation out of North Salem High School. And she was a young girl who was killed a few years ago. She was a high school senior by her boyfriend.
I remember that. Her body was found in the trunk of a car.
Right, at the Golden Bridge train station. And the night before her murder, her perpetrator texted her 60 times on the cell phone.
Right.
So they do a lot of this kind of work, education about cyber respect and behavior and that kind of stuff, and they might just be an interesting perspective.
Think that would be very interesting.
And if you remember, we brought Art Against Abuse down here,
right,
which was their work, and
they had sponsored that.
Yeah, yeah. So if you'd like, I could speak to them.
Hmm. Okay. Is there anybody else?
Perhaps either my sister's place or Hope's Door, because they do a lot of education in the schools as well, dealing with this issue. And they could also address, you know, your point was well taken
about
education and whether victims will come forward and testify.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, we also have been following the state laws. Which is, the state did pass a law, but it doesn't really deal with cyberbullying. It deals with actual bullying.
Right.
And the federal law has been held up because of constitutional issues, First Amendment issues. So,
Suffolk County and Albany County.
Yeah, we looked at this, but their laws were much broader than ours. I mean, those were really vague laws. They didn't require any harm. So Suffolk's been... has not gone anywhere, and Albany has been held up, and the Sanchez bill, Representative Sanchez, has a federal bill, and that's debating these very difficult issues, how far you can go. So
you may want to try you.
Oh, I was going to ask about NYSAC. What's NYSAC? NYSAC doing anything on this?
I don't think that this has been a topic that the counties have taken up. I don't recall in the 5 years I've been involved with it, but one of the things that you may want to do, we had a little example in here this morning during budget of the video conferencing capabilities. Because of there are a lot of great policy questions and issues that have come up in the meetings that we've devoted to this topic, but we do have in Albany, in the Office of the Attorney General in both houses of the legislature, we have program and committee staff that deal with this topic, have dealt with this topic over the years, and they could represent a wealth of of information that could be brought into a discussion, perhaps reaching out to, on the assembly side, their program committee staff that would be dealing with this issue, their counterparts in the Senate, put the question to the Office of the Attorney General, and see whether or not anyone up there has the capability of video conferencing with us. And it could be a half hour, 40 minutes, that's well spent in reaching out to others who have grappled with a lot of these same issues, them for the purposes of creating new law or amending existing law at the state level, and us for trying to get answers to questions that have been raised about this proposed county legislation.
I will call the Attorney General's office. I know that one of the Deputy Attorney Generals there, Maria Bulo, and ask her if they're doing it.
Yep, and that almost would be a better suggestion than asking the District Attorney's office to come back again. And
well, I think we should put him on the spot. I think we should put him on the spot. Put him on the spot.
Harassing.
Persistently.
As soon as we adjourn, I'm going to start sending him emails.
Cyberbullying.
Okay.
I've got two
Receiving
files.
What are they?
There's two
communications
that have been on the agenda for
90
days.
Okay.
My
guideline report
is full.
So. Okay.
Yeah,
so moved. Second? All in favor? Aye. 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 Opposed? Motion to adjourn?
Thank
you.
On the
part
of community services.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So you do that comparison? It might be good to, you know, put some cases, too, on the harassment.
One for Harrison 230.
Well, I do both.